Good.
I think I'm on the home straight. So I'm on the conditions on page 36, and I'm looking at condition 73A. On the right-hand side, so this is on an insertion by Mr. Lloyd. So as for the 72A, I agree with the intent of what Mr. Lloyd's setting out there. I think it would be better integrated into the plan, and in the same way as 72A, I asked if I could go away and work through that wording with Ms. Bell. I'd request the same on 73A, that there's no disagreement on what we're trying to achieve there. It's trying to get it integrated into the requirements for the plan. I don't have any other comments on construction noise and vibration conditions, so before I move on, is there any questions on that? Okay, so if
Well, you sort of said that you weren't going to deal with the operational noise at length because you and Mr. Lloyd were in agreement, but I just wanted to get a sense of, because of the scale of the modification to the site, Dr. Hevelt described the risk characterization for dust to be high. Would you characterize the risk of noise emissions from construction being disrupted high in this type of context as well?
No, this is a low risk site for construction noise and vibration, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And the reasons are that the activities that always raise flags for me are when there's extensive piling for structures, or when there's rock breaking, blasting and so forth. It's a large undertaking, but it's mainly conventional earthworks type activity, and they're spread over a relatively wide area, and there's only the construction noise and vibration in constrained urban sites where your neighbours are overlooking your site and you're breaking rock out to the boundary. They're the ones that need a real magnifying glass sort of over the process to make sure you can manage effects. In this case, we've generally got setbacks from neighbours, and where we haven't, it's when we're building noise barriers next to them. And as I say, we don't have lots of impact piling over the site. There'll be isolated areas.
And following from that, does it follow that the agreement that you expressed about the desirability of noise mitigation sooner rather than later applies to the operational noise as opposed to the construction noise?
If the operational noise barriers can be built early, then they will also provide a benefit mitigating construction noise. So in the case of the Maple Street, the Northern Bund, the majority of that could be constructed before the rest of the construction works. There's a question about if the material needs to be won from somewhere else on the site, but fundamentally that could be constructed early, and that could benefit all the Maple Street houses throughout the construction period. In the other areas where the barriers can't be constructed at the outset, potentially some temporary construction hoardings might be required near some of the houses. So there might be some temporary barriers for construction.
So there are some opportunities for early wins depending on the location and how it fits with the construction.
Yes, definitely on that northern side in particular. So if I'm cut off a question, sorry.
No.
If I move on to page 41, moving on to the operational noise conditions, noise and vibration conditions. So I'm looking at condition 85, still running down the right-hand side of the page. Council officers have helpfully tidied up a couple of typos in that 85. The deletion of subpoint A, in the council officers' versions, that's moved to the next condition, and it's given its 85 capital A. So they've taken it out of condition 85 lower A case A, and they've moved it separate. I'm ambivalent as to where that requirement sits. The thing I do mind about is that the council officers have removed the limitation of the special audible characteristics to objective tests only. So that's one of those key points of difference between myself and Mr. Lloyd.
I'll explore that with Mr. Lloyd.
Yes. So that covers 85 and 85 capital A. Talking about 85 capital B on page 42. So Mr. Lloyd has inserted a condition applying a noise limit of 65 at the site boundary of all rural or residential zones. This is a point where I disagree with Mr. Lloyd. The district plan is in a minority of districts that it applies noise limits at site or zone boundaries rather than at notional boundaries in the rural zone. So the majority of district plans throughout New Zealand and the New Zealand standards recommend to apply criteria at notional boundaries. In this case, I don't know the purpose of the condition as drafted. So I've assessed effects at the houses and the notional boundary of houses, as that's where the effects will occur on residential activity. I'm not sure of the utility of setting a condition which provides additional protection for paddocks or unoccupied land that's normally unoccupied. So there's a fundamental disagreement on that point there.
Sorry to interrupt, Dr. Charles. What is a notional boundary?
Certainly. So it's the area within 20 metres of a house. And if that meets the cadastral, the site boundary, then it becomes the site boundary. So if the site boundary is 10 metres away, then it will run up to the site boundary. So it's designed to protect your outdoor living spaces, your decks and your so forth.
Thank you.
So in noise limits, it's a standard mechanism.
But is that true though of a effectively a maximum when? But what? I'm just trying to confuse. This is 65 dB in LAEQ. Where have you assessed? Oh, you've assessed that on the notional boundaries.
Yes.
But if you applied it, that condition, those little areas at the frontage of, say, the properties of Sangster Road, that may not be able to be met. Is that your point?
So on the map on the screen there, if there's a red area here and it's just into a field there, so generally it's a slightly moot point in the fact that 65 will generally be achieved based on the modelling, but there's a couple of areas where it may be slightly exceeded but cause no adverse effect. So I don't see the rationale for putting a hard noise limit on that.
So, you don't object to that standard if it's the notional boundary. You don't object to that condition if it's referenced to the notional boundary?
Not as a criteria under the management plan. That is the upper limit that we're working to. Potentially, if there was a house where it was utility spaces that were exposed to that level, then there still wouldn't be adverse effects. So if it was conditioned, I'd recommend it had as far as practicable or so forth in the condition.
I'm slightly confused about that.
Can I jump in? How, from your understanding, would that condition sit alongside condition 85?
which also refers to limits. So my understanding, condition 85 basically limits operational activities to 55.
That's right. At the black dashed line, and Mr. Lloyd's applying a secondary criteria closer to the site. So right. Compliance with the 55 at the black dashed line will ensure the 65 doesn't end up too close, but it may still just nip over the edge of the site.
But you have done the modelling. You have some. There seems to be reasonably confident it will be outside the 20 notional boundary residences.
Yes.
So if we apply the notional boundary as opposed to the zone boundary, it's really achieving what your modelling is saying.
It should be achieved, yes.
Well, it must be achieved?
It's certainly the design aim. My only hesitation is, because everything is very much on the cusp in some areas, that you may end up with a exceedance that causes no adverse effect, and then you've created a condition that sort of takes away the flexibility to.
Well, my problem with that is that A, people want some certainty, and B, you then get into an acoustician's debate about the whole question of whether that's an adverse effect, which can be a bit like a nightmare. I was thinking of the book that was written about the trial. I can't remember the name of the author, but the idea is it's a nightmare to unravel. I don't want to really put people in that situation.
No, and I understand the issue. So the certainty that we're giving is that there's a absolute limit inside the house, so yeah. The treatment has to be provided to meet that limit. There's also then the certainty that the overall envelope can't go past the 55 line. I think that 65 should be met at the notional boundary of all houses, and the modelling indicates it should be achieved. I'm just wary of putting a condition to control something where there may not be an effect, and it might constrain.
My sense is that 65, exceeding 65, around the notional boundary of the house that includes utilities is not okay.
Yes, in my report I've set out that 65 I consider generally incompatible with residential activities.
So I think if we reach that conclusion, I can understand your point about the notional boundary, but I find it difficult to accept that with that allowance we shouldn't have a rule or a condition of that type.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Okay.
I'm certainly not advocating for a different, well, not advocating for anything, but not suggesting there should be a different outcome. Turning to 85C, and there's an insertion by Mr. Lloyd setting out internal noise limits in a whole range of different types of spaces. And this is as opposed to in over two pages on page 45. On the left-hand side, condition 90, subpart E, there are noise limits specified in bedrooms and other habitable spaces. So rather, in the officer's version, they've crossed out that 90, lowercase e, and instead they've inserted this large table in 85, capital C. Generally, I agree with the criteria that are sitting in 85, capital C. I don't think a lot of the criteria are necessary because the spaces that are listed aren't within the noise exposure that will require to be treated. So the receivers around the site are primarily residential dwellings, and so the treatment is mainly around the residential dwellings. And in terms of the night noise issues, most of something like Bunnythorpe School won't be occupied through the night period, such that it would be triggered by a night noise criterion. So in terms of the performance standards, that there's no sort of fundamental point of difference, but in my view it's adding quite a bit of complexity where actually condition 90E is capturing the important criterion. And I'd also note that condition 90E is consistent with the numbers that are in the district plan for the land use controls when it's the other way around.
Yeah, I'm not following this. It might have just phased out, but can you explain that again?
So, as we went through earlier, under the operational noise and vibration management plan, before KiwiRail changes something, adds something, changes activity, it does a detailed assessment, it looks at the houses that might be affected.
Yeah.
And if it exceeds a threshold value, it has to then investigate those houses and treat them to achieve internal levels.
Yeah.
So those internal levels in the KiwiRail version are sitting in 90 lowercase e, and in the officer's version, they're sitting in 85 uppercase C. In the officer's version, they've added a lot of extra categories like healthcare facilities, hospitals, overnight medical care, and wards. To my knowledge, there are no hospitals with overnight medical care and wards within the noise predictions or the boundaries. So I don't disagree that that's an appropriate number in that type of space, but I don't think that's necessary to specify in these conditions.
So this is, again, another upper maximum before treatment.
This is the internal level after treatment.
After treatment. If you express it as a condition without linking it to the treatment, aren't you then caught if someone doesn't accept treatment and then
you
haven't met the level?
You're putting an onus on KiwiRail to do something it can't deliver because it's a third-party property. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that can't work.
No. Which is why.
Is that your point?
Yes. Okay. Well, in my opinion, it's also the integrity of that management plan that is the place that you get to step through the process, which has the various steps. So that was 85. Uppercase C.
But the point behind it, though, is that you should, in the management plan, make or respond reasonably to requests to achieve that level of amenity.
Yes.
And it may be that there's a halfway house between this condition and your management plan condition, which starts to be more explicit about what needs to be achieved and what would be reasonable.
Yes.
And that sort of captures Ms. Austin, my discussion with Ms. Austin to talk to Ms. Bell is to get that. But I understand your point.
So if I move on to 85D, which is a similar issue, but the 85D has raised an important point that was omitted from the KiwiRail conditions. The KiwiRail conditions do not explicitly say that the treatment is at KiwiRail's cost. So as for the other ones, I think it'll be worth us going through this wording and adding to the operational noise and vibration management plan to make sure those aspects are specified.
There appears to be some lack of relationship between 85C and 85D that makes it problematic.
Between 85C and D and 90. So 90 is the current framework where all these things should happen. And then 85C and D have pulled out bits of that and they've elaborated on it in some places. And in some cases, those elaborations should always have been in 90, and I think that should be revised. But in others, I think it's unhelpful that it separates the process.
Yep.
So that was 85 CND, 86. The council have suggested deleting as far as practicable. With vibration, there's such a large range of sensitivities, and the materiality of small changes may be negligible. So I'd recommend keeping it as far as practicable in there. Moving down, there's no comments on 87, 88, 89. That's all about the process for and requirements for the management plan. We all seem to be in agreement on that. Condition 90, the council officers had made various amendments. They generally relate to those previous ones we've already discussed in 85 C and D. And I think as part of that, I'd like the opportunity to work with Ms. Bell and potentially Mr. Lloyd to refine that condition 90 to try and pull those things together.
I would be grateful if you did. But I see, I haven't quite worked that through in my head yet, but I understand what you're saying.
Condition 91, making information available on websites, very important thing, good idea. No disagreement there. And condition 92, there's no disagreement there. So condition 92 is the one that came up several times in our conversation earlier about the process by which when things change in 10, 15, 20 years' time, this is the condition that then triggers.
Oh, okay, so this, which one is that one? So
92, lowercase b. So examples of changes that that I'd foresee is the locomotive fleet may change. Well, it certainly will change at some point in the future, and that would be a point in time at which the noise contours for this site would need to be reassessed. Or if there is a substantial new contract for regular movement with a big increase in freight, that may again trigger a reassessment. So a rail yard will always have the day-to-day changes, there'll always be differences, and you're not constantly remodelling noise. But when you've got those significant events, that should trigger this condition to review the modelling.
So you don't have any problem with the annual review?
No, and I think for an awful lot of years there will be no change, but I think it's important to check that so that if someone made a judgment that some other change wasn't material, it then at least gets picked up in the annual review if there's a oversight at that stage. That's quite common on the airports and ports. And I say, from a noise management point of view, you tend to find as staff change or you're trying to catch incremental changes, and through having an annual review, it keeps an overview of that process. I've finished.
All right.
Welcome to take any more questions.
I'm just going to make an observation more than a question necessarily. And it's regarding the discussion that we've been having around the purpose of management plans. And this is something you raised on Monday, seems like a while ago now, Ms. Arthur Young, in terms of the St. Clair principles for management plans. I have recently been schooled by the Commissioner Edmonds approach to management plans, going through the court process. And one of the things that she certainly was very clear about in her opinion is the purpose of a management plan is to demonstrate, of other things, how compliance is going to be achieved with particular conditions of consent, which might be, in this case, the envelope of effects which are permitted. And I wonder, and obviously the council will respond to this and Ms. Bell will consider it as well, is whether the changes that the council has proposed in this regard is to provide that certainty around the scope and the envelope of effects, with the management, the ONVMP, being the means to achieve that. So that's just an observation. on my part that I think the St Clair approach to management plans probably needs to be read in the context of what management plans are there to achieve. Mm. That's not a question, obviously.
Doesn't sound like
that. No, no.
Sounds like a warning.
Yeah. Maybe. I will ask a question now, though. And Dr. Charles knows of, well, probably knows of, had quite a bit of involvement with Transmission Gully myself over the last 8 years, and a high degree of familiarity with the conditions, particularly those related to particular properties which are adjacent to the motorway. I was interested in the different approaches being taken, and I signalled this earlier, between the dust management plan and the operational noise management plan in particular, in that the dust plan, and certainly those conditions in the transmission gully suite, talk about particular properties and particular engagement and consultation with those particular properties in advance as well, and just wondered why you'd proposed a different approach for this. Was there more certainty with Transmission Gully that you were able to identify specific properties and list those compared to
yes,
this proposal?
Yes, so Transmission Gully, in the notice of requirement phase, there was a alignment, traffic flow, we could predict noise levels based on those parameters. When the construction design was made, there was a modification to the alignment, but there was a fixed source that there's a piece of asphalt on the ground that will be there for the next 50, 100 years, however long. So you can predict with reasonable certainty where the noise exposure will occur. We can't do the same for this site.
And I suppose this is, again, it misspell ultimately, but that's possible with dust to be done, because there is a slight difference in approach that I've noted. So that's just something really to be looked at, not so much you, Dr. Charles. Otherwise, I had questions, but you've been very clear and thorough, and we've already asked you questions along the way, so nothing further from me. Thank you.
Kia ora no, Dr. Charles. Yes, I did have a lot more questions for you, but I'm sure any and all of the questions I had that were of any substance at all have been thoroughly canvassed and thrashed out in the course of the interaction you've had with the panel so far. So thank you for your patience and for your very considered responses. I just have a couple of very easy and quick questions of clarification for you. On page 17 of your evidence, you refer there to the curfew at paragraphs 8.5 to 8.7, and this is in response to the numerous submissions received seeking to curtail the hours of operation during nighttime. And you've already alluded to this in terms of the framework that you've developed to deal with the effects of nighttime operations. Just at paragraph 8.6 there, I was interested to get some clarification from you on your reference to some freight hub operations that can be conducted in compliance with Category A nighttime noise criteria, which is set to avoid sleep disturbance. Are there other freight hub operations that you were thinking of there that have some parallel or, related kind of characteristics to the proposed freight hub that you could draw our attention to?
So a good example would be if a road truck enters the freight hub site, drives into the freight forwarding area, goes into a warehouse and unloads, it's probably going to comply with 45 decibels at all of the houses.
So
there's a whole range of minor activities that won't break the noise limits. If a train gets marshalled and it's at the northern end of the site near the houses, the chances are it might exceed the limit. So it depends on what activities. It may be that some container handling could comply with the 45,
right?
But it depends on the particular scenario. So the point I was making, depending on what activities need to occur, might be fine, or if it's more intense activities, Keyrail then got to go out in advance, some time in advance, and start treating houses. It knows it needs to undertake more intense activities at night.
Yes, yes.
I think I drew attention briefly in my evidence. The site layout's quite advantageous. The workshop area, so that's essentially replicating the existing activity at in Palmerston North, and that doesn't operate at night. So by exception, if there's some mechanical problem and they've got to fix something urgently, they might. But 99.9% of the time, that's a daytime operation. There's people on daytime. So a lot of the elements of the hub would never work at night anyway. And then it depends on the nature of the activity, whether they're there.
Okay. And so by indoor activity and lower noise generating vehicles and equipment, what can you just elaborate a little bit more on what those activities may entail and whether or not they are proposed, if you know at this point, perhaps it's a detailed design.
I don't know exactly what the nighttime scenario is. But the examples of lower noise, things like road trucks, standard road, would probably comply. And indoor activities, this is within those freight forwarding facilities.
Right.
Forklift, if the doors are shut and there's a forklift truck moving inside, would almost certainly comply.
Thank you for that. And just one more quick question. You've mentioned the treatment of houses that may be affected by noise impacts that don't meet the Category A criteria. What if particular houses, for whatever reason, can't be treated to a level that complies with those criteria? Is that conceivable?
It's unlikely. So it's conceivable that residents would not want the treatment.
Right.
So some people do not like mechanical. Most people prefer to open windows and use mechanical ventilation. So some people might turn down the offer of mechanical ventilation. If you had a heritage property, then you might be restricted in treating windows, but I'm not aware of any properties that would be in that category here.
So, is it conceivable, though, that somebody who wants all the bells and whistles as far as treatment's concerned and everything that is possible is done to treat that house, to bring it up to the standard required, is it conceivable then that there may be situations where houses just don't comply?
I can't conceive of a realistic situation where that would occur. Yeah. I'd probably construct a hypothetical situation,
but it doesn't generally.
I can't, because the level of reduction we're trying to achieve is not substantial.
I see. Thank you. So not really conceivable, but if the scenario you posited was to materialise and people turned down the opportunity for treatment, what mitigation then would be available?
So there wouldn't be, at that point, if KiwiRail had worked in good faith with the homeowner to investigate what mitigation would be effective acoustically, and you know, not causing other adverse effects to the house.
Yeah.
And if the homeowner made a choice not to take that on,
right,
then that's as far as
KiwiRail
could take it. Yes.
Right, that's the end of the road. So there wouldn't at that point be any consideration of going outside of the designation or extending the designation limit or purchasing the house or that kind of, offset type of mitigation or compensation. Would that be considered at that point or?
No.
Okay. Thank you. I think those are all my questions. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon, Dr. Charles. I'm afraid I have something I want to explore in a bit more depth because there's something that has passed me by. And your very helpful explanations. So my understanding is that you've put in place your 55 decibel daytime noise boundary as a marker to say we need to control our operation so that we don't exceed 55 decibels daytime during this area or in this area. Am I correct in that?
At any time.
Yeah. So if we've got that 55 decibel we can't exceed limit in place for a specific area, that's the daytime noise limit. But at night time, you've got to keep to the 45 decibels interior. What I'm struggling to understand is, given the information we had from Mr. Moyles earlier in the week, that there isn't necessarily a huge difference between nighttime and daytime operations within the hub, because a lot of it's dependent on whether it's domestic freight or freight for export. I'm just struggling to understand how that 55 decibel embargo, if you like, is useful when you've then got a nighttime limit of 45 decibels.
Certainly.
Can you explain that for me, please?
An identical situation occurs for most airports in the country, and it occurs for Palmerston North Airport. So Palmerston North Airport, they modelled contours at different distances, and then they've set a control boundary at one of those contours. If you control the noise at that contour, you also control the noise at the other contours, because you can't magically create 10 decibels more over here without increasing the level sort of further in. The advantage of controlling the noise closer to the site is that it can be measured. As you get further away from the site at 45 decibels, if you go around the edge of the blue line, you'd be measuring rural noises and cars passing by, and you wouldn't be able to actually attribute noise to the site. So from a practical point of view, the best control is the line that's closer to the site, and that, by proxy, controls the exposure at other distances. So that's what you'll find for, I'll say, the airports and the ports in particular, is they'll use those wider contours for land use controls on activities moving in around the infrastructure. But the emissions from the infrastructure itself will be tied to just one of them. And for the airports, it's the air noise boundary, and I can't remember what it's called, ports, the inner control boundary, I think, in the port standard. So it's the same concept.
I understand that. What I'm struggling with is the correlation between the daytime and the nighttime noise within your noise boundary.
So if the nighttime operation, so in response to the previous question, the likelihood is that the nighttime operations will be less, even if it's just the fact the workshops aren't going, but the actual freight activity, if that was exactly the same daytime and nighttime, then at night, the envelope that I've assessed is the one that's shown on the screen, and the 45 contour would cover a wide area, and KiwiRail would be investigating hundreds of houses for treatment to mitigate the effects to make sure people had reasonable conditions for sleep.
Okay, so essentially that option is still available. It's not that the 55 boundary is you don't look further than that. So the nighttime noise effects, that if you do have the same level of operations and that same level of noise. It just means that the liability extends significantly,
yes,
and it's up to Kiwi Rail to then address that at individual properties.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Much clearer. Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of the assessment, the extent of activity on the site will vary both as to its location and intensity. And in our site visit, we observe times of activity and times of relative inactivity. In this model, there's an assumption of those sources operating cumulatively together. To that extent, is that one of the reasons you describe it as conservative?
Yes.
Okay. I don't have any other questions because I did the job on the way through.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Dr. Charles.
How are our energy levels feeling for design?
Well, mine's are always low and after noise experts. But,
Can you possibly comment? Absolutely riveting. Riveting. Sorry, Nigel. Sorry, Stephen.
So in terms of the next witness is Ms. Rimmer,
Ms. Rimmer.
And we're at 4:28.
Yep.
I wonder whether we insert her tomorrow and break, because I can't speak for anyone else, but I've actually found this quite grueling, so I need to break.
It's a weird story. But no, it's been a heavy lifting day. There's been a lot of technical evidence, actually, not just to put it on the fascinating acoustic work, but it's been a heavy lifting day, and as much as, again, I'd like to keep trucking, I think it feels... totally in your hands, sir, but I'm very happy to break now and come back fresh tomorrow for one more witness.
So we have, though, at 9 a.m.
Submitter, yes,
a submitter.
Yes.
Do we have a submitter number?
Number six.
Is that on our list?
It the is, number? Yes. The Woodfields, submitter it's number six.
It's on the schedule, which is online.
Right. So, I see.
And sir, just it's in the evidence too, but in the bundle, your own bundle, there is a submitter map as well, so you'll be able to follow tomorrow and next week where submitters are, and very helpfully numbered by the council.
Thank you, Kat. Excuse me, sir. Just one more piece of admin, but David Murphy, you know, was initially listed on this schedule as appearing with a submitter. I've spoken with Mr. Murphy and he's been taken off the list. He's not going to be appearing with that submitter. But I just wanted to raise this with you because his memorandum is attached to Ms. Cobblestone's evidence and a few questions have been directed to that. So I wanted to put the invitation to the panel to make them available to answer questions with the reporting officer's group, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I would like that. I'm particularly interested also in the strategic planning aspects of expanding the city boundary.
Thank you. We noted that.
Yeah.
Ask them to address
one. Sir, just through you, I may be lagging. Is a suggestion there, Mr. Murphy is appearing for the council, yes? Not with a submitter,
well,
or has provided submitter evidence?
He hasn't provided
really confused by
an independent expert report or anything like that, but simply that his report was made available. My invitation was just if the council had any questions about that report, sorry, the commissioners, that he could answer questions. So I don't want to say that he's an expert for the reporting officers, but nevertheless, he can be made available for questions.
Well, as I say, I'd be interested to know a bit about the expansion of the boundary and the rationale for that. I also think it would be useful to have the diagrams attached to his evidence as separate diagrams at some stage, separate image or PDF files. And on that point, it would be very useful to have an electronic version of this with the tabs. Oh, you've got that.
But
and are they tabbed?
Finish here, yeah.
With a TOC and a PDF reader, so you can sort of...
Then also that in the electronic version, they've got sort of placeholders with which breaks up the various plans into tabs that Jacob can show you on the...
Oh, I see. So
it's a little more lines. It's a little more lo-fi than hyperlinked, but it will clearly show you the tab.
Yeah, so someone could I can get someone to put a TOC, which is where you have a table of contents on the side, because that's actually a very useful resource for us.
We can do that.
Thank you. All right, well, I hope you have a pleasant evening. I don't envy Ms. Bell working with Mr. Dr. Charles on the conditions.
Yeah,
I can tell you, I'm probably going to have a better afternoon than you.
It's some real below-the-line stuff here, isn't it, Dr. Charles? Thank you. So just to clarify, submitter 9 a.m., and then after that submitter, we'll hear from Ms. Rimmer, yes?
Yeah.
And then adjourn so we can do our homework and come back on Friday morning with Ms. Bell, yes?
Correct.
Thank you, sir.